today, I started by highlighting a few problems one has with treating the canonical quantum constraints in canonical quantum gravity. Especially the Hamiltonian constraint presents a number of difficulties. And then I started introducing an alternative classical formulation, with the idea being to base kind of an alternative canonical quantization on a different set of variables. And what were these variables? Well, they were, to start with, of the type of one introduced Fierbein variables or tetrad variables. They basically kind of corresponded to, you know, taking the square root of the metric, while at the same time introducing new kind of internal rotational degrees of freedom of, you know, on the internal these internal frame indices, plus a spin connection. So of course, well, the connection is kind of is linear in the is a first order in derivatives in the tetrad. So the first, what a first order formulation means is that to start with, you consider both of these variable sets as independent, but then you compute the equations of motion, then you find basically you can, you know, substitute one set into the other to get then your more familiar looking second order equations back. Then I specified, well, a variant of this first order formulation, which has been known for a long time. So a new variant that appeared in the mid-80s was to take, well, special combinations of these variables, you might say, and then end up with a set of Young-Mills-like variables. So these were, oops, Young-Mills variables. AI of X EBJ of X. And I confused some people by saying these were electric fields. Well, actually, they are generalizations of electric fields with an additional index, in this case is B. Well, and on the gauge potential, we have the A. So that is the internal index, in our case, referring to rotations of spatial frames, SO3 rotations. That's what this index refers to. The other ones, the I and the J, are spatial indices. Now, if I was doing electrodynamics, my internal gauge algebra, gauge group index, would assume only a single value because I have a one-dimensional gauge group U1. And therefore, of course, naturally, you just drop this index, right? So then you would have just single index objects with just a spatial index on them. But these are now really of Young-Mills type, so where you have a higher dimensional, usually non-abelian a group, and that index A and B refer then to the internal, is an internal algebra index, and usually that would be SUN. Now, for our purposes, it's SO3, or as I said, what one usually uses, something is this essentially equivalent, is SU2. Yeah, question.
Is that how you said that the electric field is basically just a Tetrian?
Yes.
But like in the Young-Mills theory, you don't have tetra, just have the connection. So, how
is that to make the analogy? No, of course, in electromagnetism, you wouldn't call that a triad. Just here, you have, well, because, well, it gives you an isomorphism between the tangent space indices and the internal rotational frames. And of course, in order for that to exist, to start with, they have to be of the same dimension. So, if I had just a single gauge index, I could never interpret it that way. Okay. The analogy. The analogy is at the level of saying these are now my conjugate variables, canonically conjugate variable pairs. And it just, well, if this was an SUN index, and, well, where n wasn't equal to 2, then I would have a mismatch of dimension, well, between, you know, the internal space corresponding to the internal space and the tangent space. So then it would never have an interpretation as a driver. Does that answer your question? So it's only for a very special case of gauge group, if you like, that now happens to be SL3, that, well, this is up to a density factor, is just a triad field, and can be interpreted this way. Okay. What I'm saying is, what I was emphasizing is to say, but hey, look, this is now a special case of actually canonically conjugate pairs, which I would write down for a Young-Mills theory if I treated it canonically. And therefore, you know, let me, what do I usually do with these variables, or what can I do when I do Young-Mills theory? And one of the things we can do is actually introduce these holonomy variables. So I've just written this down again. So a holonomy matrix takes its value in the gauge group. So the local finite dimensional gauge group. And here it would be an SL3, the group SL3. Essentially what I'm doing, roughly speaking, is we are exponentiating algebra elements. And for the algebra elements, there are the A's. Of course, the A's are just the coefficients, but of course, the algebra elements are of the kind A, capital AA, dotted into a bunch of Lie algebra generators. Okay. When I exponentiate those, I hope it's plausible to you that I actually get a group element. Now, here I do it in a manner that actually where the gauge group generator comes from is a field assignment that lives on sigma. Before I start anything, it's just given to me. So the point is, the A configuration is given to me. Then I just pick, say, A curve going from some final to some endpoint. And then I construct an object that depends both on A and on the curve. Okay? And it's basically, well, roughly speaking, I integrate up the A and I exponentiate it. What you were meant to take away from the problem sheet yesterday was to say, because this A, especially in our case, now takes its value in a non-abelian Lie algebra, I have to pay attention on how I order these A's, you know, as I integrate them and exponentiate them. And this writing this P here just specifies exactly the order in which this is supposed to happen, namely the path order. And if you're familiar with kind of a time ordered products from quantum field theory, this is exactly analogous. But here I'm ordering things according to the value of a parameter of a path. Okay? So this is what this object is. Now, why is this interesting? Well, if I go one step further and I choose a special path, gamma, in such a way that gamma of S naught equals gamma of S1, that means I still have a non-trivial curve, but it just so happens that the image points coincide of the initial and the final parameter value. So often this is 0 and 1. So if that is the case, then, as you found out yesterday, actually that, well, these things still transform non-trivially. Okay? And the way they transform under local gauge transformations is, well, we called it omega yesterday on the problem sheet. Let me revert to calling this g of x. These guys transform according, let me call this point x naught, and let me call this point x1. Then they transform according to what the local gauge transformation does at those endpoints. So here we have the A S naught S one G X zero. So a G is an element of the local gauge group, that is a copy of the finite dimensional Lie group, in this case S of three, has been attached to any point of sigma. Right. So I look at what it is at x1, and I take the inverse, I look what it was at x, what it is at x0, and performing, well, under a gauge transformation of that kind, these things to perform non-trivially. If I now look at the special case where that was a closed loop, then, of course, this would be, well, the x1 would equal the x0, then these would be inverses of each other. They are still, this doesn't cancel, I mean, they don't cancel each other as long as this here is, this was a non-abelian gauge group. If it was an abelian gauge group already at this stage, then you could pull through this, pass the holonomy U, and it would cancel with this thing to give you unity in the group. For a non-abelian group, this is in general not the case, but if you then take the trace, so if that, for this case that now x1 happened to be equal to x0, and I take the trace, then I can use the cyclic property of the trace to bring this factor over here, and then they would cancel. And the result is then, so this is what is called a Wilson loop. So Wilson loop. And so I think I introduced the notation. I'm not sure. I introduced it yesterday. Call it capital W for Wilson, depending on a closed curve gamma, and of course the assignment, the connection, the gauge potential, and is given by trace U gamma of A. And actually, it also now, because again of the cyclicity of the trace, it doesn't depend any longer on which point I had chosen as a starting point of my parametrization. It's completely forgotten about this. So the nice property of this is, of course, that it no longer transforms under gauge transformations. Right? So it's, in principle, it's with respect to this local gauge transformation, it's physical information. So it's kind of, it relates in a direct way to observable quantities. And that makes it such an interesting quantity to study in gauge theories. It gives you gauge invariant information. And of course, well, the slight catch, one might say, is it introduces a non-locality, because here I'm looking not at a single point, the field at a single point, but I'm integrating it around a closed loop, which by necessity has to have some non-trivial, you know, be it even just infinitesimal extension. So it's not a local object. It's not a local a field anymore. So what I wanted, continue this argument and getting back to the Wilson loop. So here, my gauge group for gravity, let me just choose it now to be this double cover SU2. And then, of course, as I already emphasized, it means, of course, I have extended the phase space further with respect to the previous geometric formulation. So I have now an extended, let me call it, therefore, unphysical phase space spanned by these variable pairs, and it's of the form of a cotangent bundle. Now, if that doesn't mean much to you, don't worry. So this is a configuration space, and this is just the space where I've kind of added all the momentum variables. So that is a space of twice the dimension of the space of all gauge potential, SU2 gauge potentials. So that's one way of writing it. Now, this is not too bad as spaces come. This is not linear, but it's not a vector space, but almost. This is an affine space, actually. So the space of connections. Okay, now, and as we then also said, well, this suggests a suggestion that is somewhat complementary to what you did when you worked with the matrix, the three matrix, and the conjugate variables. It suggests kind of a Young-Mills-like quantization, where A hat, I'm dropping all the indices for now, acts on wave functions by multiplication, and the E acts by partial differentiation. Of course, up to some constants. Just that was a rough idea. And now, well, I say unphysical, by that I mean it still contains a lot of gauge redundancy. So the physical degrees of freedom are buried in here. Now, what you can do in principle when you do just Young-Mills, then one could have the idea to now go to kind of new coordinates which live on not on this extended space, but live on kind of the quotient space with respect to the gauge degrees of freedom, the local, the internal SU2 rotations. And of course, the form this takes in the Hamiltonian picture is that this amounts to having three first class constraints around. And we have to follow this twofold procedure of reducing ourselves to a submanifold and then quotienting out on that submanifold by the group action that is still non-trivial there. Now, if we confine ourselves for the time being, just looking at what happens on the configuration space, how we can take care of the gauge redundancy there, then, so the idea one might have is to actually choose these Wilson loops as one's coordinates, if you like, in inverted commas. So choose these Wilson loops as coordinates on, well, the space of equivalence classes, so for which I'm now using this quotient notation, which should by now be familiar from you, from what we did, you know, when we were talking about geometry's modulo diffeomorphism. So this means I start with the space of all gauge potentials, and I identify pairs, well, I identify all of those for which I have a local gauge transformation, so something like that here, that gets me from one to the other. So and I only look, so this is again, you know, a space of equivalence classes, or the space of gauge orbits. So where you've then got rid of these internal degrees of freedom. So in gamma, of course, it was a spatial loop. Spatial loop inside these three slices. So the idea is actually, well, it's not unfamiliar from gauge theory, but the idea was now specifically to do this in gravity, so in this new formulation of gravity in terms of these Young-Mills-like variables, to get rid already of part of the redundancy by just using Wilson loops. Like taking the Wilson loops of the classical theory and kind of trying to promote them to well-defined quantum operators in the quantization. So why do I put coordinates in inverted commas? First of all, you know, I already told you they are, they're non-local. So, well, in what sense they are coordinates is, of course, debatable. But what is true is that if you know for all, when you have a compact gauge group, the information contained in all of these Wilson loops, so where I vary, you know, over all gamma, allows me to reconstruct a given A, of course, up to gauge transformations. So therefore, if I know, you know, some A, some unknown A is given to me, it's just defined somewhere on here on the surface, then the statement is, if I know all of these W of gammas, then I can reconstruct for you the A locally modulo gauge transformations, because of course the gauge transformations I have, well, they're insensitive to. That was the whole point. Okay. So classically, one can certainly go back and forth between those, although of course one has also to say this is now a huge space. If I let, you know, gamma vary through all possible curves, well, this is kind of a very infinite dimensional space compared to the space of the A's. So there is some redundancy again in the set of Wilson loops. I don't actually need all of the loops in order to reconstruct A. And to get rid of that redundancy, well, is potentially then also an issue. Okay. So now, so this is the idea that was put forward in 1990 by Carlo Rovelli and by Lee Smolin. So why don't we quantize gravity based on these kind of Wilson loop variables, coordinates? And of course, you know, since then that has been turned into a very active quantization program, and many, many people have worked on that, including myself, I should say. Okay, so this is one thing. Now, the idea is, now, because we have already said, well, quantization is kind of non-trivial. So we want to have a non-perturbative quantization. And we want non-perturbative meaning that we want to be able to talk about configurations that are very far away from any classical solutions. Now, one way of going about this is to say, well, now I've made a certain choice at the classical level. Kind of the kind of variables I'm interested in are these Wilson loops. Now, I'm addressing the issue of, you know, the ambiguities of the quantum theory and how to set this up. And recall that we also had an issue about, well, we won't be able to consistently quantize all phase-space function. I'm now making a choice. I'm saying, now, let these be my kind of my preferred classical quantities. And let me just, you know, concentrate on those and try to elevate them to quantum operators. So that it is a choice. And one, of course, one can debate whether it's good. But the idea is to promote now the set of these Wilson loops. So functionals of loops and connections, plus some kind of suitable momentum variables that are of a similar nature. Let me now not go into what these are, to well-defined operators in the quantum theory. So it's a specific choice, but this lays the basis for loop quantum gravity. So that is kind of the key thing one is assuming here. So it's a non-trivial assumption. Well, of course, whether it works is one thing, or whether, you know, what kind of alternative choices may lead, you know, to other solutions is another. But of course, one is so starved for reasonable approaches which get one anywhere, you know, that's certainly fruitful to say, okay, let's now push this and see how far we get in doing this. Now, what does this kind of imply for the quantum theory, making this assumption? It really means that kind of there are some fundamental excitations in the quantum theory where the dynamical degrees of freedom, so kind of what was in the metric, is excited only along one-dimensional curves, if you like. So that's what behind this promotion to well-defined quantum operators. So that's the picture one has. That a typical state then corresponds kind of to the metric being excited along these one-dimensional loops. One-dimensional curves. And well, actually, in the process of doing that, it turned out that it's not sufficient to look at these kind of non-intersecting loops or even, you know, just knotting them is just not sufficient. And also one needs to build in intersections. So one needs to allow this too. And that leads one to considering really graphs, kind of embedded graphs in the three-dimensional manifold sigma, which can intersect in all kinds of complicated ways. So curves or graphs in sigma. In sigma. And then, you know, once one has kind of settled on this language, one is then led back to this issue of, well, you know, which graphs, which sets of graphs do I have to consider to capture the complete information I'm interested in, and also not to make that hugely redundant. And that turns out to be solved by going to a specific kind of, well, quantities which are called spin network states. So what are these? So they kind of label independent quantum states of Wilson loop type. So they explicitly project down kind of to the quotient where you've modded out the gauge transformation. And they depend, so a spin network, well, it's just basically a graph and with intersections. So, you know, can be very complicated in principle with intersections of high valence, and associated with this graph are certain assignments of certain data, kind of spin assignments. So to the edges you assign certain spins, J0, J1, etc. And to these intersections you assign certain other kind of objects from the gauge groups that are called intertwiners that tell you basically how certain lines are to be contracted or how they're certain, so J, of course, different J's mean correspond to different representations of SU2, and so what I want to say is there are two types of data that enter here, so the graph itself and certain assignment of things that know about the group, about the group structure. So these spin network states turn out to be, give a nice basis once you've settled on trying on having wave functions, having wave functions depend on connections, but not on any old connections, but on having them depend on connections through Wilson loop type dependence, as is written here. Okay. Now, again, a very long story, and already textbooks have been written about this. Now, one very nice outcome of this is that we have a well-defined Hilbert space unlike what we had in the metric formulation at that stage. And the Hilbert space is not yet the physical Hilbert space, but is still some auxiliary Hilbert space of square integrable functions on A over G, this quotient space. So, of course, this is non-trivial stuff because we're talking now about infinite dimensional, you know, function spaces. So A over G, where this loop construction enters, these Wilson loops that enter, and there is a specific measure on this space, which one can show is essentially unique. D mu and AL stand for Ashtekar and Lewandowski. So two scientists associated with this kind of canonical measure on this space of wave functions, the Hilbert space. And to be completely technical, that is actually one considers a certain limiting procedure, and one completes kind of a space of Wilson loops with respect to this limiting procedure. Technical details are completely irrelevant for the present discussion, but just to say there is a nice auxiliary Hilbert space now on this quotient, this gauge where we factored out by gauge. It's an internal gauge. Of course, you might say, well, now we've worked our way back to where we already were in the metric formulation because we added additional degrees of freedom, these internal rotations, and now we've got rid of them. But of course, now, or this Hilbert space now, well, doesn't remind you of anything you were looking at in the metric formulation. So it looks now completely different. Now you have these Wilson loop variables, you have wave functions that are labeled by these kind of spin network states. So it seems a completely different ball game. And of course, one cannot try and see how the old problem of now representing kind of the other four quantum constraints, how it plays out on this new kinematical auxiliary Hilbert space. And again, obviously, one could hold a complete lecture series, of course, on this, the details of this construction alone. Now, if we look at the remaining four constraints, we still have the three spatial diffeomorphism constraints to worry about. And these now can be implemented, however, as we implemented them in a formal manner already for the metric formulation. So they will actually act by applying kind of a diffeomorphism on these special quantum states labeled by spin networks to the effect that a state that is annihilated by the spatial diffeomorphisms can be thought of as one that doesn't depend on the specific embedded graph, but only kind of a diffeomorphism equivalence class of such a graph. So it's constant whenever I move this graph, roughly speaking, with all its other labels, assignments, if I move this around according to some diffeomorphisms. So if my functional or my wave function is such that it does not change under such a transformation, then it's a it's almost physical. I still have to impose a Hamiltonian constraint, but it's then one has solved, in a way, the spatial diffeomorphism constraints. So by going from objects like this, or from wave functions that are labeled by objects of this kind, to wave functions that are labeled by diffeomorphism equivalence classes of these objects. So roughly speaking, of course, there's a technical way of expressing that and with various caveats, but that is that's the essence of the story. So that's actually not too bad, and one can make push this kind of further, this mathematical construction. However, then, of course, you know, in the end, one has to face the music somehow and has to deal with the Hamiltonian constraint again. And as we already saw, in this kind of the real incarnation, I mean, where one hasn't complexified this framework, this is, again, is just a very, very complicated operator. Now, there are some suggested quantum implementations of this Hamiltonian constraint, and what they basically do in terms of how they act on spin network states, they manipulate, you know, kind of applying now the Hamiltonian constraint, which of course was a kind of a complicated differential, functional differential operator. Now, the way it turns out to act or possibly act on these guys or on wave functions labeled by these is to do something to the underlying graph somehow. And things like decorating, drawing in new lines, removing others. So locally manipulating the graph on which a wave function depends. So it has a kind of, it can be encoded in a kind of graphic way. You know, you give me a wave function, I operate on it with the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian does locally, it changes things on the graph. So these are the types of Hamiltonians that people have considered. So where, so H perp, so, you know, some quantized version has now what I call kind of a combinatorial action. Action on these spin network states. So which are really you can think of as a refined version of these Wilson loop states. So one can do even more. So one has then actually, as I said, some suggestions of how to quantize all of the constraints. So all the four constraints that were there already in the metric formulation. And actually, with specific choices, one can actually achieve that the algebra of those, one can make it a close on shell. So the commutator algebra of these operators now so commutator algebra, so this is all quantum theory. Algebra close on shell. What means on shell? That usually means, well, when the equations of motion are satisfied, but here it means, well, something similar, on the simultaneous kernel of all the constraints. So the kernel, right, are just the wave functions that are annihilated or lie in the zero eigenspace of simultaneous zero eigenspace of all these four quantum constraints, four times infinity, I should say. And this is a result due to Tiemann, 1996. So you see, well, at least on the face of things, this looks really like very definite progress compared to what one could do in this geometric formulation. However, one should say that a number of really serious problems and difficulties still remain. Yeah, question.
You start with a complete SO3-1 group. You never do the 3+1 composition, but go directly to which groups?
Yes. People have tried this. Then they don't form a nice algebra anymore. So you get a deformation of the canonical algebra, and when you then try and introduce Wilson loops for these unreduced connections, you get extra stuff on the right-hand side, which makes your life complicated. But there are, actually, even now, there are people who actively consider such alternatives. We can, if you're interested in detail, we can talk about this afterwards. So, but people have tried, of course, variations also of this approach, because this is the complexified version that people had originally got kind of stuck there. But of course, one might think of modifying this again slightly to make headway. So, what are the serious issues that remain? So first of all, this combinatorial action turns out to be of a very local nature. So I told you, it amounts to addressing locally vertices, removing edges, inserting edges, and it's unclear. Some people would say it's doubtful that it actually captures, because it's maybe too local, it's ultra-local, that it actually captures the dynamics, the classical, that was inherent in the classical analog of this. Remember, I told you, when I wrote down the Dirac algebra, I told you, well, this actually has a geometric interpretation. So the fact that this algebra is there, it actually means that you have these surfaces, and what the algebra captures, also the right-hand side of the algebra, for the case of the Hamiltonian, was that it's like deformations of the surfaces. So what is encoded into that algebra is just geometric information of, we are talking about class GR, in a way. So that sits in the algebra. Now what I'm writing here is the algebra closes on shell, what it means is one has identified some subspace of wave functions, which is annihilated by all of those, and on those wave functions, all the right-hand sides of the Dirac algebra are zero by definition. Which means, actually, we cannot claim, so we don't know what it is off shell, in a way. And we don't even know whether there is any quantization in a way I would see the full structure of the Dirac algebra in the quantum theory. Because if I saw that, then I could say, aha, look, I know this is just the geometric information that I saw classically, and it has a specific geometric meaning, and ha, look, here I find it back in the quantum theory. So it's clear that I'm talking about, a quantization of general relativity. So this result is actually, unfortunately, it's much less. So if one has a complaint or a suspicion that maybe this, the implementations of the quantum Hamiltonian constraints that people have given have some wrong properties or don't capture part or all of the relevant physics, we wouldn't know. From the fact that the algebra closes on shell, we just don't know what it does. So so that's certainly a problem. And of course, a huge looming problem is that we still need to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. And certainly, classes one has identified here are very small, so very unlikely, again, unlikely to capture all of the degrees of freedom that are there, if they capture anything at all. So, and one doesn't know anything but rather trivial-looking solutions in terms of wave functions to these constraints. I think actually this only applies. You recall that the Hamiltonian had two pieces, where they had a piece EEF, then had a long kind of other piece, and they were just very complicated. So it just, well, one doesn't know how to write down general solutions of these things. So one has very little handle on this. In the process of coming up with a specific H, quantized H-perp, there are, of course, again, many, many ambiguities. One factor orders, one regularizes these things in a specific way. And that brings in ambiguities, yeah, which we, well, which need to be dealt with or need to be understood. And that also has happened only to a very limited extent. So in a way, of course, one needs some of the old difficulties again, which one already had in the metric approach. One certainly has a much better defined kind of kinematical setting, but of course, that's not the end yet. I mean, there is still work to do, and it seems to hinge on this operator here. And yeah, it's just extremely difficult to do anything with this, and many, many things have been tried. So there is very big literature on all of these issues. And of course, books have been written on loop quantum gravity. So there are a couple of monographs appeared in Cambridge University Press, one by Rovelli and one by Tiemann, where all of these, well, many of these things are explained in great detail. Now, one way out, and well, one avenue that people have followed was, is to say, okay, again, this is full quantum gravity, difficult. Let us try and use a quantization formalism that is at the very least inspired by this loop quantum gravity constructions, but let us consider reduced models, like cosmological models that just have a finite number of degrees of freedom, and let us, well, play around with those, and let's try and extract some phenomenology that might interest cosmologists. I think that's great. So that's, again, you know, hundreds of papers that have been written that goes by the name of loop quantum cosmology. What it has to do with the full theory is just a big question mark. And of course, people try to understand, can they draw lessons, you know, from that for the full theory? It's very complicated. It's highly unclear, I would say. And from that point of view, it's actually like standard cosmology in terms of metric variables, which of course also people have played around with for a long time in models. How does that relate to a full theory of quantum gravity? Do any of the results one derives in these reduced models, which also have a high degree of ambiguity usually, do any of these survive in the full theory? Well, we don't know, because we do not have at this stage a sufficiently complete a full theory. So my personal outlook on this is that it seems to me that it's, I would say, impossible to make much progress with this operator. So that's not only my opinion, but I think de facto, of course, many people who have tried to work with this have realized that it's somewhat of an impasse here. And at that stage, one reconsiders and says, okay, now we've been pushing, you know, this canonical formalism for very long. Well, let us remember what we were doing, you know, what people were doing before that, and then, well, we were doing, you know, covariant quantization. Can we go back to this? Maybe with the insights we've gained from this canonical picture, can we either pass integral quantizations that are non-perturbative, maybe inspired by this loop picture? That leads you to some models that people have considered. They're called spin foam models, which many people at PI here work on. Or even simpler, can we do away with specific choices that let us down this route, you know, of choosing these Wilson loops, making the assumption that they become well-defined operators in the quantum theory. And this is not a particularly innocent assumption because, for instance, for quantum gauge theory, it doesn't work. So it turns out to be the wrong thing to do. So Wilson loops, using kind of Wilson loops there, unless you're doing actually lattice theory, but that's a slightly different game. If you're doing Young-Mills theory in the continuum, then these Wilson loops or the analogs are actually ill-defined and highly singular objects in the quantum theory. So unlike what one is postulating to happen here, they're very, very singular, so they need to be regularized. People have tried to use them anyway, but one tries to write down equations of motion in terms of these Wilson loops in Young-Mills theory, and one finds that the beauty that these equations have before one regularizes them is unfortunately lost upon regularization and renormalization. So there are other quantization programs in non-perturbative Young-Mills theory, which in the past have tried to follow a similar path. Again, of course, here you can argue, well, the dynamical content of gravity is, of course, totally different. So it doesn't mean if I had a negative result for Young-Mills theory, it implies that it's not going to work here. Maybe there are even good reasons that it should work in gravity and not in Young-Mills. But, of course, as long as we haven't kind of gone to the end of the road, well, there's still something, of course, to prove for us. Okay, so basically, so that ends my, for the purposes of this course, that ends my discussion, you know, about a canonical quantum gravity. Of course, this was very, very brief, but it will now at least allow me to spend a few more lectures on covariant non-perturbative quantization. And I'll just spend a few minutes today by way of introducing what we're going to expand on during the rest of the week. So the covariant, so that is in a way picking up from what we did in week one, when I introduced the perturbative path integral as kind of the standard quantization that was first tried for the gravitational field. What we'll now look at is a kind of what a non-perturbative implementation of that would entail. Gravitational This is also called, because of the nature of the path here, it's also called a sum over histories. And again, kind of the formal expression I had on the blackboard in some previous lecture, so let me choose again the symbol Z here for the path integral. What I want to do is I want to make form a functional integration over geometry. So these were the notation of equivalence classes I introduced. So this was, I wanted to perform the integration over kind of some quotient space where I have got rid of the diffeomorphism degrees of freedom already. And here I have complex weights, amplitudes, where each of the amplitudes, the weight associated with each g mu nu is just the e to the I, the Einstein-Hilbert action. And lambda is a cosmological constant term, which we put in there for generality. That was Newton's constant, of course. And that's an expression we considered back towards the end of week one. Now, what do I mean by a non-perturbative implementation? A non-perturbative and also so-called background-independent implementation. So first thing is, let me start with the latter. So what do I mean by background independent? Well, when I was doing, of course, a perturbative path integral, these things were very much dependent on a choice of background, because remember, we decompose the metric into a background piece, eta mu nu, plus linear perturbations, f mu nu. So, and actually, so this was kind of the background, and to the order we treated this, we never considered any back reactions of the dynamics of the f's on the manifold itself. So we really treated that as fields on that fixed background metric eta mu nu. And of course, in principle, well, this makes the things depend on this eta, whether it's very visible or not very visible. It just, one has singled out a specific classical solution and said, okay, you know, I stay in the vicinity of that and try and construct my quantum theory. So the background independent version is a prescription that is not going to do that. So it's not singling out any one geometry, classical solution, typically, one means by that. So on the, it will be, so I capture this by saying it's a democratic sum. So, you know, each geometry has equal status a priori in contributing to the path integral. So no particular geometry is singled out. By my kinematical setup in any way. So I try not to bias myself from the outset. So, and secondly, so what is interpreted by non-perturbative, I've now said many times, there is no condition that I should stay close to any classical solution, be it in eta mu nu or otherwise. So large, in particular also large fluctuations of curvature are allowed, and yeah, you can be anywhere kind of in the space of all geometries. In a way, of course, background independence is a feature already of the classical theory, because what you do, you know, classically is, you know, you have the Einstein equations, and before you haven't solved the Einstein equation, you don't know what the space-time is. So only the dynamics of the theory then singles out certain spaces as solutions to these complicated equations. So a similar strategy one would like to adopt in this non-perturbative quantum gravity, namely that, you know, one wants to put forward a dynamic quantum dynamical principle, and then dynamically, you know, a specific metric, some with quantum properties maybe on Schwarzschild, should drop out. So as a solution to the quantum dynamical principle. So it's, well, it's not an unfamiliar way of thinking. Of course, how to go about it concretely and get results is, well, is of course a more different story. So what I will show now in the treatment I'll present to you over the course of the next lectures is to address the many kind of ill-defined features that lurk now behind this very, very formal expression here. In order, so I will tell you how to make kind of every bit, you know, of this right-hand side kind of meaningful and well-defined. And of course, it will involve a regularization, because we're talking about, again, a quantum field theory. So you know, some of the things that you've learned in QFT will apply, of course, you know, in terms of philosophy. So let me just give you a preview of the kind of issues one has to sort out in order to make this meaningful. So I will show you first how to, in a concrete kind of setting, to kind of work directly on the quotient space. So that is this space here. And I call this, well, the space of geometries. Not, don't mix it up now with the space of gauge, local gauge transformations. Curly G of M is just the space of equivalence classes of the Lorentzian metrics. modulo now four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. And, well, what is a way to regularize this path integral? That means to make it finite at some intermediate stage so one can, you know, extract information from it, regularize, and kind of renormalize it, kind of deal with infinities that occur on the way. A third issue, which I already mentioned to you, is non-trivial, is how to weak rotate so that these oscillatory complex integrals become real, so to enable me to discuss kind of convergence properties or otherwise of these integrals. So that goes by, you know, how to deal with the I. And something I also briefly mentioned in passing, how to deal with a very peculiar property of this gravitational dynamics, namely the fact that this action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, is unbounded below. Remember maybe the argument I made when I talked about properties of the De Witt metric. The De Witt metric appeared when I wrote down a kinematic, isolated, a kinematic piece from the Einstein-Hilbert action. When I wanted to rewrite it in kind of canonical form, I get a p dot squared term. But I get, of course, the p's have various components, and they are contracted with this Wheeler-De Witt metric. And then I mentioned to you this Wheeler-De Witt metric has a very unusual property, namely its signature is not positive definite. There is a single minus. There is one mode that contributes with the wrong sign. And that leads to kind of the Hamiltonian, you know, the p squared term, to have a negative mode which potentially, which renders the Einstein-Hilbert action unbounded below. So that's a very unusual property. And it's true for both Euclidean and for Lorentzian signature. So it comes from the Wheeler-De Witt metric, and it was this conformal thickness. This is associated with the blowing up mode. So how to deal with this, we'll also see. And so what we'll start doing actually is address these points by building a kind of a regularized version of this path integral, very much in the spirit of what we did for the non-relativistic particle. You know, remember we had this kind of we looked at a piecewise linear path and then applied a certain limiting procedure and a weak rotation to get out the simple standard quantum mechanics of a non-relativistic particle. Now the paths will now become entire histories, so spatial geometries as we trace them through their time evolution. So a single path will be now an entire universe with all its curvature properties, which is of course a somewhat more complicated object than just a little wiggly particle path. Okay. More on this from tomorrow onwards.